Cecil Beaton has been immortalized in both the glamorous photos he took of himself and of others. But the man himself has remained elusive. Now, Lisa Immordino Vreeland's gorgeous documentary, Love Cecil, the many different parts of him come together in an intriguing whole. You can go see the movie at the Film Society of Lincoln Center's Eleanor Bunnen Monroe Film Center on West 65th Street. But in the meantime, we're lucky to have director-producer Lisa Immordino Vreeland here with us today. Lisa, welcome.
Welcome to you, and thank you for inviting me.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things I was so struck by watching this film was that Cecil is one of those people who I think I've always been aware of his work, but I didn't know who the man was.
Well, that's what's funny about some of these characters, because, you know, Beaton was, he was really kind of within my world for a long time, and I guess my first memory was My Fair Lady. And then when I started to collect photography, he was, you know, it was a yet another level. And what's so fascinating about him was that he had his hands in so many different things and for such a long period of time, because from the 1920s to the 70s, he was really part of the creative realm and in a lot of different fields. And so he was not only photographing, he was writing, he was drawing, he was painting, he was doing costume design, he was doing set design. So he's part of one of those multi-talented visionaries that, you know, were part of this 20th century and that were fascinating and seemed to always intrigue me.
And he definitely seemed to be one of those people who was born at the right time, because he seemed to step into so many different different changes in the culture of the 20th century at the right moment. But I want to go back to his beginning. So he is English and was born in England to, I believe, an upper middle class family.
An upper middle class, but let's not forget, upper middle class wasn't good enough for him.
Yes, and I want to talk about what role class played in driving him, because that was with him for his whole life.
It certainly wasn't, but it was very much part of the English at that time. And, you know, it played, because you said, you know, he fell into it. Well, he kind of pushed himself into it as well, because, you know, ambition, his talent was at an equal balance with his ambition. And I think that that's also played against him at times, because, and, you know, it could be thought of in a negative light, but I have to say that, you know, when you're 5 or 6 years old and you are striving to be part of a different class, because, you know, and I still feel that today the class system in England is very important, not as it was back then, but you were born into something. So he always had to, I mean, once he entered the class system, he wanted to, and he did really by the 20s, because he became a bright young thing, and the bright young things really were mostly wealthy families.
But I think that also fits into another driving force in his life and looking for that place to fit. Because the bright young things, I guess, what was this, like the 1920s?
It was very much a reaction from World War I. And it were these wealthy families, the kids from the wealthy families, that they just, you know, they wanted to be hedonistic. It was about play. It was about masquerade. It was about, it was just an unrealistic approach to life. And it totally fit with this theatrical, fantastical view on life that Beaton had. So he really fell into it with ease.
Mm-hmm. But it was also sort of this play with this non-binary sort of, you know, dressing in drag and just expressing yourself, not just artistically, but even sexually. Like, they were open.
They were totally open.
They'd be club kids today.
Oh, they were definitely club kids. And you know what? And the thing is that when we were looking through the imagery, we kept saying, this is such a conversation of now, of today. He is so relevant in so many ways, and especially those pictures of the bright young things. And when he was, you know, when he was in Cambridge and he was at university, he was not interested in the study part. For him, the studies were the theatrical world that he could step into. And he was kept continuing to recreate himself visually, because he would be in a dress with pearls, you know, crawling up his arms, and he would be constantly trying to find some kind of new interpretation of who he was. And he then applied that skill also to all the portraits that he was taking. And this whole idea that he would then transcend into doing these selfies, which was another very contemporary thing.
Yes, before they were selfies.
And he was doing, I mean, he placed himself in amongst the most creative people of the 20th century. When he was taking their portrait, he would all of a sudden be in the portrait with them. And it's a great way to be able to see this whole, the whole 20th century unfold is through his eyes.
Well, speaking of that, so there's a point in his life where he gets an opportunity to come to New York. And in addition to taking these very sort of like exquisite Baroque type portraits of people, he's now doing street photography. And that changes his perspective.
It does. Well, you know, New York, so he, at that time he was coming and he was really hoping he was going to be able to leave with the contract from Condé Nast and to be working for American Vogue. And he was working for British Vogue at the time, and he came. And he, you know, he had this ability also to also not only have a very strong professional life in America, but also a social life. So he was very vibrant in both ends of his life here. And he also then started to take these street pictures. And these are the kind of works that are more, that really come out in this film, because it's that street photography of New York. It's the World War II photography that are parts of the realm of his work that people don't know as much, and that I find absolutely fascinating. And very different from the portraiture that we're all much more familiar with.
I'm speaking with filmmaker Lisa Imerdino Vreeland about her new documentary, Love, Cecil. So speaking of his war photography, so first we should probably back up a little bit and say there was a very critical moment in his life. And that was during the time when he was working for Condé Nast, he created a cartoon that included some anti-Semitic slang in it.
Yes, and that was, it was a mistake, and it was, it, this is his insecurity that really drove him to do this, because there was never, you know, he apologized, but he didn't quite say, he never said why he did that, and it was completely wrong, and it was published, and the news of this was then published in papers worldwide, and it haunted him, his contract, both with American and English Condé Nast, were finished. And he found himself back in England without any work and shame. And But it was his insecurities, because he said, you know, I was overworked. I was, you know, being pushed for too many different deadlines. He did it. And it wasn't caught until the magazine ran. And so they had to destroy over 100,000 copies of it, which was at a huge expense to Condé Nast.
Yeah.
And there would be something that would creep into his life until the very end of his life. And it was only because the Queen Mother then asked him to start to take portrait of the royal family that things started to change, because all of a sudden he was introducing a new kind of language to royal photography.
I believe he changed the way that we see the royal family.
He did very much, because there was an informality. There was a way that the rest of the world could relate to the royal family, which was quite different.
Now, I do want to go back, though, so after he leaves Condé Nast, or the contract is broken and he's back in England, it happens to be at the same time of the Blitz and the beginning of World War II, at least, in the European theater. He, at one point, picks up his camera and is just like, I'm going outside, I'm going to capture what's happening to London, my city.
And and this is something that I did not know as much going in. And so it was great to be able to discover all of this and to see, because believe it or not, at the Imperial War Museum in London, they have every photograph that he ever took in these big workbooks, and you can just go through and see them. And he wanted to do something. He knew he couldn't be frontline. And so he ended up working for the Ministry of Information, so they would own all of the film. And he went around to all the different theaters of war in the world and took pictures. He was not frontline taking pictures, but he got the spirit of what it was all about. And what was interesting is that his photography changed during that time, because he was never a photographer's photographer. He wouldn't go to the dark room. But also, all of a sudden, there was a seriousness to it. There was the format. There were these square images that came out. It was just the cropping of the images. There was a technique that wasn't part of his work before that all of a sudden started to shine through these images. And we see a different image of what the war was about.
Well, and in the documentary, he talks about, you know, approaching his subjects with definitely his own point of view. But at the same time, he manages to capture a sense or a level of humanity that I don't think that you usually see in war photography. You saw that in his photographs of some of the soldiers in their off-duty moments. But more importantly, you saw that in this photograph that he took of a little girl that ended up on the cover of Time.
Certainly. And there's a spirit. I think he captured the spirit, and it was something he introduced, kind of a soul to war photography that hadn't been part of it before. And it's a very important body of work that really people didn't know about that much before. And so it's really nice to be able to showcase it in the film the way we did.
It is. And there's a wealth of photographs. I mean, it was like somebody I think I read described it as watching a really beautiful slideshow. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, how did you get access to all of those photographs?
Well, we were so lucky because all the archives really are in the UK, and Sotheby's has the Cecil Beaton Studio Archive. There's the Imperial War Museum, all the royal portraitures at the V&A. And, you know, what was nice is that when you're dealing with a character as creative as Beaton, we also as filmmakers then had to decide, we had to make the film as creative as Beaton. And that was a challenge, obviously, because the bar is set very high. And also you're dealing with black and white photography. And, you know, you would think, you're like, oh gosh, it's going to be, you know, horribly boring for people to have to look at these photographs. But we decide to put motion graphics on them. We did washes of color. And so the images come alive in a different way, and they're always timed with music. You know, and then we had these beautiful scrapbooks because he just, you know, he never stopped creating. And we even wanted to, we had these scrapbook pages come alive, and we wanted the film to be as textured as his life was. And I do feel that we achieved that in the end. And it was a great challenge, but it was so much fun. And it was really a matter of editing, because we had access to thousands of photographs. And it was about picking what we felt was right for his historical view of what people know about him, but then to show these really interesting and diverse imagery that people don't know about.
And of course, some of the scrapbooking that you would be talking about were the illustrations sort of coming to life as animations.
Yes.
Okay. I thought that was really cool. So with all of the wealth and this body of work that you had, you still were able to capture the actual man because you use excerpts from his diaries.
Yes. Yes. So this is, you know, beside creating all the work that he was doing, he was also writing diaries. There are over 100 diaries that are St. John's College in Cambridge, and then there are these 38 published books, and a lot of them contain excerpts of the diaries. So all of our dialogue, the voiceover for the film, was literally right there. And he was a great, great writer, and he was introspective, and he really made his own life come alive. And it was, and for us, it was just a gift to have all of this. And so, just, you know, we also had archival film footage and interviews of him, but it was really these diaries that made it come alive.
And I think that was added the really personal touch to them. I'm Jenna Flanagan, and I've been speaking with filmmaker Lisa Imerdino Vreeland about her new documentary, Love, Cecil. Love, Cecil is playing at the Film Society in Lincoln Center, Eleanor Bunnen Monroe Film Center. It opens tomorrow at Cinema Village, and on July 14th and 15th, it will screen at the Nighthawk Cinema in Brooklyn. For tickets and for more information, you can visit our show page at wnyc.org. This is Midday on WNYC, and we'll be right back after a break.